is rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, good evening. Welcome to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Tonight, we have with us a returnee. We've talked to Nate before about his incredible program, I Am Driftwood, which chronicles the stories of LGBTQ individuals in very dramatic ways, telling really heartfelt, wonderful tales about their lives and getting people to know the diversity of the spectrum of LGBTQ people. Well, he is under a new aspect of that project in which the I'm from Driftwood is actually going on the road. And one of those is going to be in Washington, D.C. on May 16th. We have Nate on tonight. He's going to tell us all about that. And without further ado, I will bring on Brody Levesque. Welcome to the show, Brody.
Hey, Rob, good evening. And to our listeners, good evening, good evening. Rob, I've got a little bit of housekeeping and kind of a request that came to us from Kathy Baldock, who is a friend of the show. She's actually been a guest. She's a good friend of mine. She is an LGBTQI activist and advocate ally in Reno, Nevada. And she is also friends with one of the folks that are on American Idol right now, who is in the contention to go all the way through to the end, nice young man from Catonsville, Maryland, who I know as a Facebook friend, and I met a couple times actually. His name is Jeremiah Lloyd Harmon. I want to give Jeremiah and his partner a shout out. And to our listeners, Jeremiah is kind of like everybody else, a little impoverished and needs a little bit of help. So we're going to ask that if you got a couple extra bucks here and there to help Jeremiah and his husband as they're staying in Los Angeles, as they're finishing up the ride on American Idol, if you could send that along to Team Jer, that's JER.com. They would really appreciate it. And a big shout out to Mama Bear Ruth Roberts, who was kind of spearheading that effort. Rob, that's housekeeping.
Okay, before you move on, I want to fill in a little bit of the gaps there on Jeremiah. Those who haven't seen the show, you need to go back and watch the story about Jeremiah. It is, I mean, we're talking tonight about I'm from Driftwood, and Jeremiah's story is certainly that caliber of a story. The most recent episode that they did is getting to know that I think it's the top 10, of which Jeremiah is one of them. And I think he is a pretty favored one, to be honest with you. But at his very first audition, he did a song that he wrote himself, which is very unusual for when people show up and audition for this thing. They usually do a pop song and everything else that's really recognizable. But he did one that he wrote himself, and he came in and introduced himself as being the janitor of the church. And the church was one where his father was a pastor. And throughout the season, it's been a story of how his family has rejected him and he's kind of doing this on his own. And as he has reached the top 10, his family has started to come around, be supportive. His sister showed up on one recent episode. It is really a heartfelt LGBTQ story to watch. And he is incredible. He's incredibly talented. The three judges were completely bowed away with his audition that he wrote himself, and so he should go really far. So anything that you can support to get on Team Jeremiah at this point, go for it. Anyway, Just a little 2 cents there, Brody.
Oh, no, no, that's actually good. That's fine. Jeremiah and his boyfriend, John Keister, will be absolutely, absolutely appreciative of this. It's an extremely interesting backstory because one of my young people that I mentored, who's a pastor of a church now in San Diego, California Mission Gathering, Brandon Robertson, went to Jeremiah's father's church. That actually was his church. So there's a lot of inside baseball in this particular instance, because Jeremiah and I have run in several circles that, you know, literally cross over each other. And I'd actually sent him a quick note asking him to get a hold of me, because I wanted Jeremiah to actually get a hold of Nate and contribute to I'm From Driftwood, because he does have virtually one of those kind of stories that is just as fascinating. And as Nate will tell you, I am chronically terminally ill when it comes down to constantly making recommendations to I'm From Driftwood. Because I, as a journalist, I run across these stories all the time. We probably have a very special listener tonight on Rated LGBT Radio, and I want to give a shout out to Nate's grandma. So, Nate's grandma, if you are in fact listening, your grandson is just simply amazing. I think the world of him. I've known him since 2007, and it's pretty cool. So, props off. Your grandson's good people. With that, unfortunately, I got to shift gears, because we do have something kind of unfortunate that we need to talk about before we bring Nate on. As you know, the Trump administration has now enacted a rule from Health and Human Services, and that's just kind of one of those things where, you know, we combat this in the community all the time, but this one's pretty bad. This will allow healthcare professionals and others to essentially discriminate against, particularly the trans community, but against people, and this would include women, based on their religious beliefs. And when I say women, I'm, of course, obviously talking about women's reproductive rights. It's an extremely unfortunate situation. And I think that one of the things that we need to be aware of is that we still have to look very hard, until this administration ends, at the fact that this is going to, continue to be a serious issue. There's been discussions back and forth on this about, in terms of the constitutionality. I will say probably more than likely what's going to happen is that this will get challenged. It will be taken into court. And as is the case with most of these types of rules and regulations coming out of the Trump administration, when they do get challenged, I'm fairly certain that the legal teams will probably ask for an injunction, or at least a preliminary injunction, to stop the rule from going into full effect. But, we do need to, keep our eye on the ball. Things are still going to be ugly for the LGBTQI community, as we've seen from what's happened with, our trans service members. And we talked about that, of course, with Shannon Minter and some of our, and Bryn Tannehill, and some of our friends on the show previously. But I'd like to remind our listeners that most of the attorneys that I have spoken to, and a lot of the other attorneys that have weighed in on this, are of the opinion that a person's religious beliefs should not give them a license to discriminate. And that, this is something that we really have to kind of bring to the forefront of the argument, Rob.
No, we do, and it's I'm not sure what the light at the end of this particular tunnel is short term, to be honest with you.
I don't either. I think it's extremely unfortunate, And again, we have to be able to, you know, to look at this in a very realistic fashion. Earlier this week, the Williams Institute put out a new study on gun violence as it affects our community. And the problem, and I wrote about this for the Los Angeles Blade newspaper, and I spoke with our friend Brandon Wolf and our friend John Becker. The problem is that the statistics that are gathered from a local, state, and federal level and then are compiled into the crime statistics reports that are used for these studies by the FBI, an FBI spokesperson told me that, you know, they don't, there's no accounting for the LGBTQI community. It's almost like there's an erasure there. It's just, so the specifics of what this does to the community isn't there. So you've got a flip of a dynamic between the Trump administration saying, okay, well, your religious beliefs will allow you to discriminate, yet you have gun studies and other things where we can't even get good data on how negatively, you know, gun violence affects our community. So I do believe this is something that we really seriously, you know, need to take a much harder look at, and we certainly need to address. And one last thing, of course, and this is related to not just our community, but everybody in general, and that is the current now constitutional crisis that's legitimately can be called that in Washington. The Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, decided that he was not going to testify before the House Judiciary Committee today, which I don't think that the Attorney General quite understands that, and they actually have oversight of his department. Speaker Pelosi, in an extraordinary way, went out of her way to label the Attorney General's comments and some of his conduct, particularly yesterday, in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I'll read, this is quoting Speaker Pelosi: Attorney General Barr's decision to mislead the public in his testimony to Congress was not a technicality. It was a crime. The chairperson of House Judiciary, Representative Nadler, the chairperson of Oversight and Appropriations, Chairman Cummings, and, of course, House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff from California. The gentlemen are looking at the overalls of this, and you know, I know there's a lot of people out there talking about impeachment, but unfortunately, you have a constitutional officer standing in your way, and that's the United States Senator from Kentucky, who happens to be the Senate Majority Leader, and under the rules of the Senate, which are specified in the Constitution, that those bodies are allowed to make their own rules to conduct their business, he can stop the impeachment cold before it even reaches the Senate. Speaker Pelosi and a good deal of Democratic leadership are looking at this as, you know, it's a non-starter. Yeah, you can impeach him, but then what does that get if the Senate doesn't try, convict, and throw him out? So I think that the process here now is to let the public hear all of this evidence coming out of those three committees, let the public make a determination of what they're hearing, and make their own judgment calls. And I think ultimately it'll be decided in the ballot box during the 2020 race.
I think that's where it has to be. I listen to a lot of the conservative talk radio just to keep my finger on the pulse of what is being said and the rhetoric that's being put out, and the the attempt, I think, to, in my opinion, to dumb down the conservative population is kind of a story in which they're saying there was actually no crime committed by Trump in the first place. Therefore, his flailing around afterward, nothing could actually be considered a crime because he's not obstructing justice when there wasn't a justice to obstruct, is basically the circular argument. Of course, that's not a legal argument because, you know, in the investigation of a crime, when you're trying to impede it, whether no matter what the outcome or original factor of that crime are, that's still there. The one thing that no one is really talking about, though, that seems obvious to me, is that the placement of Barr as Attorney General itself, I think, was another final act of obstruction of justice on the part of Donald Trump. I mean, Barr is acting exactly as he was meant to act and exactly as he was instructed in some form or fashion. And, you know, I think this just adds on to nothing that Barr does right now, to me, is the least bit of a surprise. And I just think that the intensity on him is maybe higher than Donald Trump anticipated would happen. But, again, I'm not shocked.
No, I'm not either. I think that when Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii referred to Barr as Trump's Roy Cohen, she pretty much nailed the descriptor. I think that's exactly what it is. You know, Barr more or less auditioned for the job with the unsolicited memorandum that he had written that, you know, outlined his position of, for all intents and purposes, unlimited presidential, you know, powers, and which was something, you know, full well that Trump latched onto. The hypocrisy, though, however, is breathtaking, as Senator Kamala Harris pointed out, and that was that, you know, the Attorney General had turned the president down as a private citizen to represent him as a private lawyer, and yet, as the President of the United States, he's, you know, just willing to jump on board, and here we go. There has become a significant disconnect. And I think that maybe Americans are really starting to realize just, you know, quite frankly, how hopelessly corrupt deeply hypocritical and quite frankly, deranged the Republican Party has become. It's, you know, Trump, I've always said this, and I've maintained this since day one. I've said this to you in private. I've said it publicly. Trump isn't the problem. Trump is the symptom of a larger disease, and it's that simple. The cancer on the body politic, to paraphrase former White House counsel John Dean when he was talking about the cancer on the presidency during Watergate, but the cancer on the body politic of the United States is the fact that it's never addressed core issues. You know, Americans have a problem with racism, they have a problem with white supremacy, and they have a problem with the separation of church and state, and they have allowed, you know, Christian supremacists to, you know, marry the political conservative right and far right. And since Ronald Reagan, it is built essentially unchecked. They've had, you know, enjoyed this for so long, and now suddenly, warts and all, along comes, you know, this reality television star who pulls the scab off or pulls the curtain back, and it's no longer, you know, you can't say, well, don't pay any attention to the man behind the curtain. No, you have to pay attention now to the man behind the curtain. You literally have to look, because the man behind the curtain is the Republican Party, and essentially the leadership of that party and then the powers to be in the party are hopelessly greedy. They are corrupt. And quite frankly, at the end of the day, if you really wanted to go down the so-called, you know, in quotation marks, biblical description, they're evil. So,
right.
Anyway,
right.
So there's that. You know.
yeah.
I want to give a special shout out to tonight's guest. Nate's a friend. I really love him to pieces. He's a great guy. The I'm From Driftwood Project is one of the most crucial projects that I can think of in the preservation of the legacy of the LGBTQI community in a contemporary and other way. It documents the stories of our lives, our history. It documents in first person and curates, you know, the LGBTQI spectrum from all backgrounds, all socioeconomic groups. And on May 16th, Nate and his crew we'll be in Washington at All Souls Unitarian Church, which is at 1500 Harvard Street in Washington. And so you guys, you know, need to pay attention to that. But I'm very much excited about this. Nate's a good guy. And without further ado, Rob, I'll hand it over to you to bring Nate on.
Okay. Well, we'll let Nate come on and talk for himself. Good evening, Nate. How are you doing? Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good evening. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you again. So, Nate, when last we talked about the whole background of I'm from Driftwood, and you've reached a new phase with that. But for the folks that aren't familiar, can you give us a little of that background again about where the project came from and what you've done with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it starts back in 2008. I had just seen the film Milk with, Sean Penn. It was written by Dustin Lance Black. And I was very moved by that film, as many people were. And the morning after watching that film, I was thinking about a popular photograph of Harvey Milk. And he's in the San Francisco Pride March. And he's sitting on the hood of the car, and he's holding this big sign that reads, "I'm from Woodmere, New York." And what that meant to me is that, what it made me think was I was surprised by that fact, because everyone associated Harvey Milk with San Francisco, this big LGBTQ mecca, but he's not from there. He's from this town that most people have never heard of. And that really resonated with me because, this was all taking place in New York for me. But I'm not from New York. I'm from a small town in Texas called Driftwood. And, what that message really meant to me is that you're not alone, no matter where you are, no matter what you're going through. And my main issue growing up gay in Driftwood was isolation. So I felt like the only gay kid in Texas, or the world for that matter. And, I know that it would have meant a whole lot to me to hear that those words, that you're not alone, there's other people like that. There's other people like you out there. So I really wanted to get that message out there through storytelling. It actually was a very strange experience. I saw Milk on a Wednesday. I woke up and thought of the idea Thursday morning. And then Friday, I went into my job and I was laid off. So it was this, I describe it as like the universe grabbing me by the scruff of the neck and saying, "This is what you're going to do." And who was I to say no? So, this is the height of the recession in 2008. I had plenty of time to work on it. And within 3 months, with the help of a lot of friends and, the community, we launched I'm from Driftwood, and we just celebrated our 10-year anniversary of collecting and sharing first-person LGBTQ stories.
Incredible. And how many stories have you collected? You may have just said it, but how many are you archived now with?
We have when we started, we were just written stories. So those were, much easier for people just to submit from wherever they were. And we have about 750 written stories. But soon after launching, we also started, one of my friends, Marcise Lee, he had this idea of doing video stories where people sit down with me and they tell me a story, and then he would film it and edit it to be a video story. So we started doing those pretty early on, and we have about almost 600 of those. So I guess that's about 1,300 total stories.
Wow.
If my math is right, 1,200 maybe. So the video stories, we don't allow user-generated content at this point, just because, even though that would make it more accessible for people to share their stories, we really help people think of what story to share and how to tell a story and make sure that there's a beginning, middle, and end, and a conflict and a resolution. So we're very storytelling focused. So, we don't want people just to talk and ramble and go on and on. So every single story that we collect is, a story worth sharing. And that said, it's completely, I also look at I'm from Driftwood as a platform. People get to share their own stories. It's whatever story they want to share. We ask people to share a story that's meaningful to them, and that's essentially it. So, what's meaningful to one person could be a simple first date or falling in love, and, you know, a meaningful story to someone else might be dealing with being gender nonconforming at the workplace. You know, so they're really kind of all over the place. But the important thing for us is that it's a meaningful story to the storyteller, because we want people to we really think it's important that people share their own stories and their own words. So.
And are all 600 on a YouTube channel, or do you only accessible through your website?
Yeah, we think it's very – we're a nonprofit organization, so our whole mission is about getting these stories in front of as many people as possible. So we upload them to YouTube and then embed those stories on our website and then promote the stories through our social media like Facebook and Instagram. And, yeah, so you can find the stories, you know, everywhere basically. So, but particularly YouTube and imfromdriftwood.org.
So now, moving back to the present day, you are embarking on essentially a roadshow. What is that? How's that working? Where did that come from?
Yeah, so it's funny. It's a little bit of a roadshow, as you called it, about a bigger roadshow. So back in 2010, you know, we were collecting stories for that first year, mostly of people in New York City and Philadelphia. And even though the stories are from everywhere, because people live, or, you know, people who live in those cities travel from all over to live there, but it still felt like we were cheating a little bit, because they all the stories, all the storytellers had decided to move to the big city. But I was, you know, the whole point of I'm from Driftwood is about the Driftwood part, like people who are from these towns and smaller cities all across the country. So that was where the idea of the 50 State Story Tour came in. And, you know, we started planning that in 2010, early 2010. And in September 2010, we did it. We started and we drove to 48 states and then flew to Alaska and Hawaii. It took 4 months. We collected 137 video stories along the way. We had about 50 story sharing events where we went to LGBT groups at college campuses. We spoke at companies and corporations, different schools and nonprofit organizations, where we shared stories from I'm from Driftwood and spoke with people. And it was just an incredible experience. It was just one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, but also one of the most rewarding things that I've ever done. You know, I'm from Driftwood was still getting its nonprofit status, so raising money was difficult. You know, it was just it was over 4 months. So it was 4 months and about 5 days. And of all those nights, we only had to stay in a motel for seven nights. Every other night, the community opened up their homes for us and let us stay with them. And, you know, that was just one extra unexpected part of the experience that was really meaningful. So it was the crew was myself and Marquise, who, you know, was a video story editor and creator, and my brother, who is a straight ally, he was a driver, so he drove us around. And it was just really an incredible experience and meaningful. And so coming up, that was 8 years ago, and this year is our 10-year anniversary. So as part of that celebration, we are putting together an exhibition, an art exhibition, that highlights the stories and the experiences. And you know, we have over 10,000 photos that we went through. So it's an exhibition about the story tour itself. So it's
amazing.
You know, just today. Yeah, about an hour ago. This is perfect timing for the show. I have a creative director helping me work on this or overseeing it, and he was sending me photos of the art that we received today, and it looks amazing. So yeah, so we're gonna the exhibition is going to start in New York a week from today. And then from there, we're going to go to Philadelphia. And then we're going to be in D.C. on, as Brody said, on Thursday, May 16th. And it's from 6 to 9 p.m. It's a free event. Tito's Handmade Vodka is sponsoring it. So there will be some booze and a lot of queer people. It will be a fun little party. So,
wonderful.
Yeah,
and Nate, the stuff that'll be on exhibit, is it all photos and stories that are on exhibit, or are you going to have a way to play some of the videos, or how is that going to be all presented?
Yeah, so there was so much to cover, and it was almost overwhelming trying to figure out how we're going to do this exhibition. And one of our friends and an oral historian told me, he was like, just show your best material. I know there's a lot of good stuff, but think about what the visitor is going to want to see and what's going to, you know, keep them interested. So that was some really good advice. But then also I wanted to kind of frame it in a way that answered the most commonly asked questions whenever I tell people we went to all 50 states. So, for example, like what you just asked, like, you know, is there a video component? So a lot of people ask, what stories did you collect? And so there is going to be a video component. We're going to have a little, I guess we're calling it a tent, you know, a little section with curtains around it and a projector showing clips of the stories that we collected. So there will, you know, be like a loop for probably a 12, 13 minute video highlighting probably about 10 or 11 of the stories. And there's also a little section that kind of introduces the team, you know, myself and Marquise and Nick. And then we had three amazing volunteers back in New York. So it kind of introduces like who was involved on this. And another one is about the van that we drove around in. There's a cute little story about how we got it and what we nicknamed it. And, you know, just because we spent a lot of time in there. The three of us spent a lot of time just about an arm's length away from each other. and one of my favorite parts is, or not favorite, but one of them is for the very first fundraiser that we had for the story tour itself, I wanted some sort of collection bucket, but I didn't want just some boring bucket. So I thought of these hot pink cowboy boots. So they would be fun to pass around and have people put money into. So I went to a thrift store and an arts and crafts store and spray painted these old cowboy boots, and they were a total hit. People absolutely loved them. And so we took them on the road with us, and we took a photograph of the pink boots in front of a landmark in every single state. And they became sort of, you know, the mascot of the story tour. So the boots themselves will be, you know, a little plexiglass box on a pedestal for people to look at. But also we're going to have this cool little grid showing all 50 photos of all 50 states, plus, of course, D.C.
Well, there should be a song about the pink cowboy boots that trudged all 50 states or something. You know, it's like
I'm gonna talk to our friend Brody Ray Runge, guitar and singer. Yeah, Brody Ray, and I think that might be a good thing for him to maybe compose and put something together. I'm sure we can come up with something. All right, well, it's time for me to play journalist. Nate, my friend,
yeah.
How are you?
Doing very well. How are you? Are you gonna be the singer of that song, Brody?
No. Are you kidding me? If I start singing, cockroaches are packing up and trying to get out fast. No. Let me ask you this. All right. I know as a journalist over the years, there are some stories that I have written about or have told that, you know, they really stand out. I mean, there's things that just stick with you. There are certain people that you meet that just absolutely leave an impression that you just can't shake. And as you and your colleagues were traveling around the United States doing this roadshow, as it were, of all the folks, probably without trying to make it prejudicial, but just kind of in balance here, tell us a little bit about maybe one, two, or three of the ones that really stood out the most.
That's always a pretty difficult question because we've, you know, all these stories have entered and passed through my brain. But as you were saying that, I was guessing what you were going to ask, and I was right. And one did jump to mind, and I think it was not necessarily because of their story, but a little bit, but just we were in Honolulu, and it was smack dab in the middle of the tour. You know, our stress was off the charts because we were felt like we were moving too fast, but also we didn't want to slow down, and you know, we were out of money, and it was just a, you know, 2 months in, but also we're in Hawaii, and I was also sick at the time, so all these things. But of course, we're also in this beautiful state, beautiful city, and we were introduced to this person named Novale Gonzalez, and they, I believe that they are gender nonconforming, so I'll use they pronouns, but they are probably, I hate guessing age, 60s, maybe 70 at the time, probably 60s, we'll say 60s. You know, long hair, longish hair, probably down to their shoulders, and a flower in their ear, and a native Hawaiian. So just to give you an idea of what they look like. And before they shared their story with us, they took us on a little walk. And there are these trees called banyan trees. And they're native to Hawaii. And they're known as like what Tarzan would swing on. So they kind of, the roots are what grow up. And, you know, so these long, really strong branches. And so they, you know, first told us about those trees and how it's connected to the Hawaiian spirit and all these things. And this wasn't even part of their story. They were just talking. And I was just like, it just hit me. I was like, I'm on this. Like, this is just so surreal. I'm in Hawaii being taught about banyan trees and the spirit of Hawaii on this big queer tour. And it was just a magical experience. And it was almost like I had a, not out of body experience, but just this outer awareness of like how lucky and fortunate and amazing our community is. And then when Novale shared their story, it was about bullying, and when they were younger, they were bullied at school, and you know they were very depressed and ran home and told their grandfather, "I hate these bullies. I'm gonna kill myself." And he said, "Whoa! Like what's going on?" And they explained it to their grandpa. And as I've been talking, I pulled up because I want to make sure I get the quote right. And the grandpa, like you know, made sure that they had eye contact. And he's like, "Hey, listen to me. No matter, you know," well, they said, "if you never remember anything else I ever tell you, I want you to remember this, that because of who you are, there will be enough people in your lifetime to love you for exactly who you are, that you never have to worry about the ones that don't." And this was, you know, this must have taken place 30 years ago, at this point, 40 years ago, because the story tour is back in 2010. And it was just such this poignant moment of you know, that moment that I had as Novale was walking us through these banyan trees, and then to share this story that was just beautiful, but, you know, showed it into their past about challenges that they have, and then this beautiful advice from their grandma, or I'm sorry, from their grandpa. It was just, yeah, so it was just a really special moment on the tour that I'll always remember.
That is hilarious. Aloha, 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 aloha.
Yes.
Wow. Well,
Nate,
moving along.
That is, I mean, your series had really tale upon tale upon tale of very unique stories, very down to earth. We were talking before we brought you on about somebody you haven't done a story on yet, but how cool it would be if you did Jeremiah, who is competing right now for American Idol. And he's already top 10, so he's already got, you know, that will bring its own set of fame. And the further he goes in that, it'll be even more and more and more. Have you done very many that are fairly high-profile LGBTQ people, or are they all kind of more common man, woman, gender-fluid people?
Yeah, a lot of people say, like, oh, you should get Ellen's story. And I'm like, okay, awesome. Introduce us, and we'll do that. We also try to strike this balance of, you know, the name is I'm from Driftwood, because I was you know, fortunate enough to be born into a town with an amazing name. But it sounds small, you know, people think I made up the name, you know, they don't know I'm actually from there because it works. It sounds small. It means, you know, all of us, it's inclusive. And, you know, if you start sharing stories of celebrities, it starts to pull away from that feeling of you and me. That being said, we have had some high profile people, and the first thing I let them know is this isn't about your celebrity. It's not about your career. It's not about, you know, who you are now. It's about I take them through the entire thing that I take everyone else through and say, I want a story that's meaningful to you involving you being LGBTQ and ideally not a coming out story. And, you know, there needs to be a conflict and a resolution. And, you know, I've been called a story bully sometimes because I really push people until they, you know, share a story with me. And, you know, so we have, I'll list off some and then I have a funny story about one of them, but we got a story from Alan Cumming, Brian Sims, who's in the Pennsylvania legislature, Dustin Lance Black. That was a real special moment meeting him since the film that he wrote inspired I'm from Driftwood. And
wow,
we got his story on the story tour.
Yeah,
that was a kind of incredible experience as well. He was so nice, and yeah, that was great. So, so also the very last stop on the story tour, we started in Driftwood, and then the last stop before we got back to Driftwood was Houston. And pulling into Houston, or, you know, a day before, we found out that then Houston Mayor Anise Parker would share a story with us. So we were very excited, and because she was mayor at the time, so, you know, mayor of a huge city, you know, we were kind of got nervous, and we're like, all right, look, you know, let's just do the same thing as we do with everyone else. And we, I forget who it was, maybe her chief of staff or someone was, sent us an email and said, you know, we just want to make sure that this story can be about anything at all, and it doesn't have to be about politics. And I said, no, in fact, it's better if it's not, you know, the more personal and meaningful and, you know, real, not that politics aren't real, but, you know, like the more personal it is, the better. And she was like, okay, cool. And then we got to City Hall, and we, you know, went through security and were introduced personally to the chief of staff, and she came out and said, you know, welcome, you know, I'll walk you up this way. And before the mayor comes out, I just want to make sure that it's okay if it's not about politics. and I said, yep, it's even better if it's not any meaningful story from her life involving her being a lesbian. And she said, okay, cool. So then we were introduced to the mayor. We went inside of her office and we were setting up the camera and putting a microphone on her. And she was very cordial and nice. And she said, before we start filming, I just want to make sure that it can be any story from my life and it doesn't have to be about politics. I you know, said the same thing. I was like, yeah, yep, absolutely. Any story, we prefer it not be about politics. So the reason I think, I didn't ask her why, but I think the reason that she kept making sure of that is because the story that she shared was wonderful. It was so good and personal, and it was about the first time she ever fell in love with a woman. And then she shared the second story, they were connected, about a lesbian romance that she had in college, and it almost got her kicked out of Rice University. And so it was this beautiful, you know, part of it, she said, you couldn't pay me all the money in the world to be a teenager again because of the heartbreak and the, you know, the raw emotions. And, you know, to hear that from a sitting mayor of what was, I guess, fourth largest city in the country, fifth largest, third largest, I don't know. But that's just so real and honest and true. And that's the kind of story that will connect to anyone, because everyone knows what it's like to have those crushes and those feelings. And,
right,
you know, like I just imagine these, you know, young teenage lesbians who might be watching this story and being like, oh my God, like that's okay. Like I'm like the mayor of Houston in that I have these feelings too. And And that was, you know, just a, I was so happy that she decided to be so real with us with the story that she shared.
No, I just love that. I love how that all worked out. I mean, I love the getting to that deep human core outside of the concept of accomplishment or notoriety for other things, and you know, how that's usually what the point of any kind of those sort of bios is. But getting it down to that just heartfelt level. Nate, one thing that, you know, a lot of anthology type works in the past from science fiction-y things like Twilight Zone or, you know, other things like that, is they have sometimes generated some stories that have gone on to inspire, you know, full-on movies, et cetera, et cetera. Have you seen different stories in your collection that you think Hollywood should move in and turn into something big like that? And if so, which stories stand out for you?
Oh, so which story is like cinematic?
That's a much more succinct way of asking it, yes.
No, I mean, I'm glad that you explained it. That's tough. You know, that's a funny question, and I don't know if I'm going to answer it, but I want to answer something right next to it, is that what we want to do is we want to end up sharing these stories in as many different ways as possible. So I've always imagined this being a multimedia story archive. So, you know, right now we do the written stories and the video stories, but later this year we're going to start working on a program for podcasts. And so it'll be audio stories, you know, because any way that people consume media and stories, I want to make sure that there are LGBTQ stories out there for them to relate to, for us to relate to. And so your question about like films is, that's always been like, I have a whole PowerPoint, you know, and one section is about films. Like there's no reason this can't be longer format video, like a TV show, or a really long format, like a film. So, you know, I could imagine this being a film class assignment is, you know, go through our archive, find a story and then add on to it. You know, all good films have a lot of dramas and relationships, and you know, you could easily just at random pull one of our stories out of a hat and then grow outwards from there to fill up a whole film, you know, because it's so many films are based on relationships. And yeah, so I the answer is yes, but I can't think of one in particular, you know, off the top of my head.
Right. I imagine that would be tough.
Yeah,
I could imagine. Trust me, after all the years and stories and people I've talked to, yeah, I completely sympathize with that. You've got a natural ability and talent for storytelling. You kind of fell into this, but at the same time, you really do have a style and an ability. What was your inspiration and what was your real looking at this going, I can do this? Because it shows, Nate. I mean, it shows in the videos. It shows in the way that you put this together. You know, it shows in the project itself. You know, people could say, well, it was just kind of random, this, that, and the other thing. But I'm always firmly committed to the idea that, you know, this is an intuitive thing, especially when you're talking about storytelling on this epic of a scale. It's not unlike what I do for a living as a journalist. Give me a little bit about you. I just realized sitting here listening to this going, you know, this is great. What's your background? How did you suddenly turn into such a master storyteller? What was, you know, how do you do this? How?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I in a way, I kind of put the cart before the horse because for some reason I knew that I wanted to get that message out there through storytelling, but I knew kind of nothing that, or I couldn't articulate that I knew anything about storytelling, and, or I didn't know that I did. And so I just knew that I wanted it to be a story, but I didn't know how to tell, you know, and I, whenever we got the stories, even from the very first one, they're stories, you know, I go back and look at them. I'm like, how did I, cause now I do it in a whole official formal way of telling people what a story is, but I didn't know that at the time. And so we started getting these stories, and then, you know, after a lot of feedback, I just started wondering, like, what is it about stories that make people have these reactions and this feedback in the comments that I'm reading? And I actually gave it as an assignment to an intern that we had one summer. And I said, I want you to go do some research and pull anything that explains why storytelling is so important. Or not important, but why it makes people feel this way and elicits these reactions. And she did an incredible job. And the reason of why storytelling is so impactful is because of something called mirror neurons. And it's in everyone's brain. And whenever you hear a story, you're activating those mirror neurons in people, in a listener's brain. And what that does is that is a scientific explanation of empathy. So, and storytelling is unique in doing that. So if you tell a story and tell it well, you know, the listener on a microscopic level is experiencing what you experience. And that's whenever you have that feeling of, oh, I get you, or I feel you. Even though I might not have ever in my life had that experience, I feel it because of those mirror neurons. Mm-hmm. And so then once I was like, oh, cool, so there's an actual reason why this is happening. Then I wanted to figure out how to maximize the activating the mirror neurons. And so then I started studying storytelling and like the storytelling structure and, you know, what makes a good story. And, you know, so then we put together this whole storyteller guide that helps people like figure out what their conflict and what their resolution is. And then, you know, I didn't want it to be a generic story, so I also added like a little I'm from Driftwood something to it. And to where it's like uniquely an I'm from Driftwood story, which is basically, you know, a setup, a basic storytelling model. But we always allow the storyteller to have some reflection at the end. And we have a few questions that we ask every single storyteller at the end. One is, I don't want to spill all my secrets, but one of them is, why is your story important to share? And almost every single time, it's like the golden question, because they're usually taken aback by it, because they almost take it defensively, like, well, like, I don't know, is it? You know, they're a little unsure. Mm-hmm. And then you almost see them push back, and it's like, no, you know what? My story is important to share. And it all happens in a split second. And whatever they say next, you know, I can imagine my editor like cutting it and just sliding it right into the end of the story. It's almost always profound. It's almost always something that I wouldn't expect. And that makes it so much more personal. So, you know, a lot of people will say, well, my story is important to share because, you know, the editor will cut that. And then whatever they say next is almost always an I'm from Driftwood ending. So if you ever watch our stories, know that that's the question that we asked at the ending. And sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it doesn't work. So we have some backup questions that we ask for that. So,
all right. Well, I'm going to do turnaround as a fair play then as a reporter. Mr. President, I have a follow-up to that last question, sir. Now, Nate, I'm from Driftwood. Why is this so critically important to you?
To me or to
and
the
to share.
Community?
And for
both,
to,
because
to
I was
going to
I was going to ask I was going to ask the same question. So, yeah, to you and to the community.
It's important to me because that's where you would cut. This is going to sound just so selfish. I look back to Nate when he was, you know, 14, 15, 16, you know, had a girlfriend, lived on this ranch with absolutely no queer culture, you know, for miles and miles away. I just imagine him in his room on dial-up internet watching these stories and just his mind being blown. And that's why it's, and I know that there are people out there that this is doing that too. And that's why it's important for me personally. And then for the community, I mean, it's kind of the same, but also for the community, I look at it more as a responsibility of providing this platform or a stage. And one way, so we publish stories weekly, every single Wednesday, and visually or a metaphor, I imagine that I'm from Driftwood as a stage, and people just take turns of going up there and saying something that's important to them that they want to share with the world. And that, for a community, is really important for people to be able to share their own stories and their own words, maybe with a little coaching from us. But, you know, it's their stories told by them. And, you know, it's not anyone else telling their stories for them. It's their own words, their own experiences. And the stage that we've built says it matters and it's important and it matters to you and it matters to the people who are listening. And so, yeah, so that's that.
Excellent. And we're running out of time, and I was going to ask the exact same question Brody just asked. So I'm glad he got it out there. So I'll ask this one instead. It's not quite as to the heart. But, Nate, how do people find out more about the series of celebrations, the timeline, and where to go for each one of them?
It is all conveniently located, as you would imagine, on 50statestorytour.com. So, and the 50 is numeric, so it's 50statestorytour.com. And, of course, the I'm From Driftwood Facebook page or, you know, our website, imfromdriftwood.org. But yeah, all the story tour exhibition is 50statestorytour.com.
Excellent. And Nate, I want to thank you so much for everything you've done. This project is just absolutely mind-blowing, phenomenal. And thank you, obviously, for coming on tonight with us. Footnote for Brody and I, always fun to have a good storyteller on the show. It's a guaranteed winner, and you are definitely on top of the heap on that. And speaking of storytellers, I want to thank Brody for his work as a journalist, his stories, and being the right-hand guy on this show and everything he does. I want to thank our listeners who get on board every week, listen to us. We'd love to hear from you. You know, feel free to give us your input on our Facebook group page, Rated LGBT Radio. And thank you for showing up. Also, don't forget on Saturday night at 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time, it is Out in Santa Cruz, and you can listen to that on www.ksco.com. For Brody and myself, thank you again for this evening. Nate, can't wait to have you back again. Just always fascinated. Thank you so very, very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, y'all.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.